Good morning. I am Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. Today, we are very pleased and honored to have astronaut, mountaineer, and medical doctor, Dr. Scott Paradnitsky, as our guest in our studio today. It is not every day that anyone has an opportunity to interview the only person in the world that has been both in space and climbed Mount Everest. Scott, welcome to the program, and thank you for interrupting your extremely busy schedule and join us to share your thoughts and insights on leadership.
Well, thank you very much, Darrell. It's a real pleasure to be here with you and talk to you again. It's been a few months since I met you at a conference, and glad to participate.
You know, I felt that that was the highlight of the conference for me, simply because I came there for a business practice. Needless that I know that I was going to have the opportunity to meet someone as great and as achievement as much achievement as you have. At the Outsell conference, you really had us intrigued about your exploits in space and your exploits in Mount Everest. But considering your very unique, dynamic, diverse background of achievement, share with our audience your background and how you decided on a career in medicine, and then, of course, being an astronaut.
Well, thank you very much, Darrell. I appreciate your kind words. I've been a beneficiary of a lot of great opportunities in life. Very supportive parents, and I had the opportunity to travel quite a bit and see the world when I was young. So, I just had a very open eye as to the challenges that the world faces, and very interested in exploration and science and figuring out ways to help solve some of those issues. So medicine was always something that really appealed to me. My grandfather was a physician. He unfortunately died before I was born, but that may have planted the seed, I guess, just the family talking about my grandfather and kind of thinking along the lines of medicine. But, when I was in junior high school, I lived West Africa and traveled around that continent and also through the Middle East and saw firsthand some of the great medical needs of the world and that really solidified my desire to pursue a career in medicine. But all the while, my father had worked with the Boeing Airplane Company early on in his career in support of the Apollo program that first sent men to the moon. And so I also had a love and fascination for everything related to aviation and space. So I had model rockets and posters on the wall and thought in the back of my mind, boy, it would be incredible someday to go fly in space myself. So that's kind of how my hybrid career got started.
So you knew as a young man, as a young child, that you wanted to go to space.
I think I did. I started off all of my talks. In fact, I think I showed it at the Outsell conference where we first met, a picture of me at age 5 holding a little model rocket in front of one of the assembly facilities in Michoud, Louisiana, where they built the first stage rocket for the Saturn V. And I guess even back at that tender age, I had high aspirations.
And take us back to your junior high school in Dakar, Senegal. I mean, most of us have just a normal junior high experience, but how was it for you to attend junior high school in another country?
Well, it was incredibly exciting and exotic for a kid who had been in just a public school in Arlington, Virginia before that. My parents were quite adventurous, and I'm an only kid, so they had the more flexibility to pick up and take this unique opportunity to go with the Boeing Airplane Company to West Africa. It was a Boeing's effort to diversify into new markets, and so he helped launch a new office there for the company. And so it was an incredible experience to live in that environment. Primarily French-speaking, but of course there are many, many different African languages spoken in and around Dakar. So I was immersed in this new environment, learned how to speak French reasonably well, I went to a Baptist missionary school. It was the only English language speaking school in town at that point, called Dekar Academy. And from there, ended up being able to travel a fair amount through Africa, Central Africa, North Africa, and East Africa. I never made it to the southern part of the continent. But for a young boy to be surrounded by all these different cultures and every day was an adventure. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that I took from early in life is the best and most important lessons in life typically come from outside of a textbook. You have to keep your eyes open for new opportunities, meet people, travel, and what you learn outside of the classroom is incredibly important.
And your parents, what an adventure that they had taken you on. And your father, is he still with Boeing or has he retired now?
My father is retired, but they had a wonderful career with the company. We spent some time in Beirut, Lebanon, in Athens, Greece, in Tehran, Iran. And, after I graduated from high school, which was in Athens, Greece, they came back to the United States for a few years, but then went back to live in Saudi Arabia for a while and then another tour in Athens, Greece. So they really had the travel bug.
Wow, exciting. And it really gives you an international perspective.
Absolutely.
Now, during your time, during your junior high and high school while you were abroad, what principal activities did you find yourself getting involved in?
I'm sorry, what kinds of activities?
Activities, sports.
Sure. I was always quite athletic, so I enjoyed basketball. It was probably my core sport, but I ran track. I wasn't very good at football. My senior year of high school was the first time we had a football team available. We had just moved to Tehran, Iran. It was the year was 1978. We lived there just for 4 months, and it was the time that the Shah was deposed, and we left right at the same time, and we weren't welcome anymore. But that first, the fall quarter of my senior year, I played football, organized football for the first time, and I discovered that I really didn't have the fearless attitude that you need for being a receiver and getting hammered by folks that are trying to kill you. So, but so that I know my limitations. But basketball was always a strong suit of mine. Played a little soccer and then ended up doing other sports later in life as well. I guess around 15 years old. That's when I started rock climbing. And that was kind of the genesis for the mountaineering that followed later in life.
Yes.
But also in school, I did student council and other types of activities within the school and went all the way through Boy Scouts and got my Eagle. So I was a busy guy.
Yes, you've had a very busy life. I was showing my wife your bio, and she just said, "Oh my goodness!" She said, "Is he married?" I said, "Yeah, married with two children."
That's
and
right.
His wife is very happy. She says, "Well, you need to do better."
Oh no! Anybody can look good on paper, Daryl. Don't believe anything you read. But my wife keeps me very well grounded.
And when did you first realize your aspiration to be a leader?
Well, I think certainly in my school age years, having the opportunity to be a leader in student council and in scouting. Scouting is a great opportunity to go out into the wilderness, somewhat into harm's way. You're responsible for not only yourself but your team, and to fend for yourself and to make the right decisions. And I think that that experience has served me extremely well over the years. One observation Currently, the Astronaut Corps uses the National Outdoor Leadership School, called NOLS, mm-hmm. More widely, as a training ground for newly assigned crews. So they'll send a crew out for 10 days into the wilderness, and you really develop a sense of your own leadership style as well as those of your crewmates, and you find out your strengths and weaknesses, areas where you need to improve, such that in the heat of battle on a mission or any other situation in life, you can hopefully choose the right leadership style and go down the right path.
And that's a very good point in regards to understanding your strengths and understanding your weaknesses. Through this program, how do you identify what your strengths and weaknesses are? Is it through some team building, role playing? Are there different psychological tests that you take to evaluate how you would decide? How do they go about to allow you to do this self-evaluation?
That's a great question, and it's very well matured over many years of these types of field exercises, not just with professionals, but with college-age kids who also take these courses. There's a lot of science behind it, but essentially, the model is you alternate the responsibility for leadership on a day-by-day basis. So you could be a leader one day, and then you're a follower on the next days, and then rotate back in. And the tasks are different. They're in challenging environments. There's navigation, care of your team, safety elements, of course. And on and on. Some of these are mountaineering environments, sea kayaking, canyoneering, things of that nature. But you do your own self-analysis of your performance. Your teammates evaluate you, and it's all out in the open. So you get direct feedback, real time, at the end of the day. And then also you, in group discussion, talk about the ways that you like to handle certain situations, and they help you identify your leadership style as well as the pitfalls of having that type of leadership style. So for an example, I tend to like to work with teams in a very open, consensual way, develop a plan as a team, and then go about business, if at all possible, because then you establish buy-in, you let everyone have a voice in the decision-making process. But certainly there are times when there's not enough time, or if the leader has more situational awareness, he or she has to act upon that, and the rest of the team has to step in line, because there could be a life threat or whatever the challenge might be. So I that's a bit mm-hmm. of a long-winded answer, but it's really an interesting process, and I'd really encourage your listeners to consider a NOLS course if they ever have the opportunity. It's a great experience.
And it's the National Outdoor
Leadership School.
Leadership School, yes. Mm-hmm. Excellent. And, is there like a before and after where that an individual, when they first start with this program at NOLS, where they're evaluated and they say, okay, here's the things I need to improve on over the course of the next 3 days or the week. And then at the end of the program, is there an evaluation or self-evaluation so the individual can see how they have grown? Or is it just so self-evident that the individual knows that, hey, I've improved over the last few days because I'm doing this and this and this better and different?
Actually, there is a very structured evaluation process. You are evaluated by your teammates and then by your guides. There are two instructors that, at least for the courses that I've been a part of, accompany you into the field. And they're also well-trained in the NOLS leadership model, so they have structured discussions in the evenings to help you understand your strengths and weaknesses and effective leadership styles. Mm-hmm. And so they'll also provide written feedback, and it only goes to you. It's not mm-hmm. something that gets publicized or shared with anyone, but it's a really valuable tool, and I've I've used it, to my benefit, many, many times.
Well, that's a program that I'm going to look forward to taking myself, because I've been through a number of leadership training exercises, and I think this is something that will challenge me physically as well, and also allow me to challenge myself mentally. So it sounds like an excellent program. I'll be sure to have this posted on our website so that folks can link right over to that. And to the point of leadership, in your opinion, what are the key traits of a foundation of a good leader that a leader really must have?
Well, I consider listening as an absolute and a critical strength for any leader, and it had been one of my pitfalls in the past. You know, if you're technically competent, if you have expertise in a certain area, it's easy to just jump in and make a decision and go with it, perhaps in advance of other people getting on the same page with you. There might be someone in the room who actually knows something more than you do or differently. And so what I try to do is be the last one around the table to speak, if I am the leader in a certain situation, to let other people share their thoughts, really try and tug out of people their honest opinions on matters before making a decision. There's certain times, of course, where you don't have that luxury of time, but I think being a good listener is just as important as being, bright, technically competent, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in your opinion, I know right now there's someone listening to this program who is doing some, they're thinking about how they can improve their particular style of leadership. How would you recommend that they get started on this path of being a great leader?
Well, I think there's certainly wonderful books out there that you can purchase and read and try and incorporate into your own style. I've always really admired General Colin Powell, so I've read a number of his books, and there are all sorts of people that you may have in your day-to-day life. There's one senior manager here at NASA that I had the opportunity to work with quite closely a few years ago, and I always try and think when I'm in a challenging situation, what would Alan do in this particular situation? And so to either actively seek out mentorship from leaders that you know and respect, or go to Amazon.com and start reading some of the great books.
Excellent, excellent. Let's talk about your space travel for a moment, because it is such an outstanding and awesome track record. 5 missions covering 23.4 million miles. You have orbited the Earth about 902 times. You have spent about 1,381 hours in space, and you've done multiple spacewalks. I mean, what an awesome track record. Of all of your experience in space, which is the one experience that really stands out as a memory that you will always have of your times in space?
Well, thank you. There have been so many amazing experiences. I kind of liken it to one of those Shirley MacLaine out of body experiences. You just can't believe that you're actually out there in this unbelievable environment, especially outside on a spacewalk. It's like a dream, clearly. But I would say my last mission, which was called STS-120, and it was a very complicated space station assembly mission, during which I did 4 spacewalks. But the most memorable was actually an unscheduled, unplanned spacewalk where we had to go repair a torn solar array. And this was something that we had never envisioned happening, had never trained for in our water tank, had no procedures for. And the failure occurred after we had relocated this large solar array truss out at the very end of the space station, and we were, by computer command, deploying the solar arrays to extend. And unfortunately, a set of guide wires had become frayed and caught on some of the panels and ripped them apart. And it was unsafe at this point for us to undock the shuttle. It was impossible for us to bring up any of the future laboratory modules because there wouldn't have been enough power to support them. So this is a critical milestone for the space program. And within 72 hours, brilliant men and women at NASA worked around the clock to figure out a way to get me out to the very tip of the space station beyond any place we'd ever been before, in a way that had never been imagined, using a kind of a jury-rigged inspection boom latched together onto the main robotic arm of the space station. It was just unbelievable. It was at the very reaches of my 6'3" reach on the end of this 90-foot-long cobbled robotic boom to get me out to this torn solar array, and I had to clip out a guide wire that had frayed and then put in stabilizing braces so that the solar array panel could be deployed. And I liken it to the space station, space shuttle era's Apollo 13. It
yes.
was what do the crew members up on orbit have available to them? What can they use to get out there, and then what can they use to fix it? And so just an amazing team effort, not only on the ground in Houston, but various NASA centers around the country, and then our entire crew was involved.
You know, I'm sitting here with chills because I remember watching you do this on CNN. And I just wait a minute, I remember that. That is awesome. I was like, man, that is really awesome what they're doing. And here I am interviewing you. Wow. This is an out-of-body experience for me, because all of a sudden all of these images of CNN and watching you repair this when you're out there in space, which was quite complex, they had reported at the time.
It was. Thank you for your kind words. It was my best day on the job ever, I've got to say. But it was a live solar array, so there were still 100 volts of energy coursing through the panel. So had to be very careful not to touch the panels in any way, especially with any metal objects associated with my suit. And we're able to go out there with careful planning and all of the training that we had done up to that point, even though this is an entirely unscripted type of spacewalk, we're able to get the job done, and that's the beauty of NASA, being able to go out and accomplish these things that are really hard, but make them look pretty easy. So,
wow. Awesome, just simply awesome. And when you before you go to a flight in space, what is the preparation that you have to go to get yourself ready for a flight?
Well, it's about 2 years of 1 to 2 years of basic training. We call it astronaut candidate training, where you learn all the basics of orbital mechanics and space weather, meteorology, space physiology. Material science and microgravity, all these different fundamentals, as well as all the space shuttle systems and then all the space station systems. And once you have the fundamentals down, then you're assigned to your first mission, which then takes a year to a year and a half to prepare for the specific elements on that particular flight. So if you're taking up a new module, you'll have to learn all the ins and outs of that. Procedures for installing it, for doing the spacewalks, to outfit it, and so on. So it's a very intense process, but it's also a lot of fun. The training environments that we have include a big water tank where we practice spacewalks. We have motion simulators that rock and roll, like the shuttle does on launch and landing. We have virtual reality simulators that allow us to practice the robotics and spacewalks that we do. and rendezvous and docking procedures. And I just love it. It's also an opportunity to work with people from around the world. The space program involves a number of international partners, to include Canada, Japan, Russia, a number of European countries, and the list continues to grow.
Wow. Okay. And I take it that the crew that's getting ready for this flight mission 2 years in advance, it's a group of folks who there's a commander of the group and who leads the group. And talk to us about the leadership protocol that happens during the preparation leading up to the flight.
Great question. Well, for a space shuttle flight, there is a mission commander who is the basically the person that will sit in the left seat and for the launch and landing and actually physically land the mission. And that person is responsible for the overall mission safety and success. So, you know, the buck stops with him or her in that seat. But there's also distributed leadership, I would say. For example, I was the lead spacewalker, so everything to do with spacewalking from our training program to the actual execution of those spacewalks and all the spacewalking crew members was on my shoulder. Of course, on my last mission, my commander, her name was Pam Melroy, a colonel in the Air Force. I would keep her up to speed on everything that we were planning to do, and of course she had ultimate veto power if she saw something wasn't going along with the overall mission priorities. But typically the way it works is distributed leadership. So we had people that were responsible for the robotic assembly tasks and on and on. You have also a very highly motivated workforce, and I rarely find myself in a position where I had to use an autocratic, leadership style. If it was the right thing to do, pretty much everyone was right on the same page with you, and you just marched off and did it.
Wow.
It's a great great environment to work in. The other thing that I would mention is that there is the space station, of course, on orbit, which has a different crew, and so there's a space station commander. And so when the two spacecraft come together and dock, then it's kind of a shared leadership between the two commanders. And then I guess the ultimate deciding authority, if there were ever that sort of a conflict, would be made by mission control.
Mm-hmm.
The lead flight director has the overall responsibility for mission safety and success.
Right, right. Well, Scott, this has been a very, very fast 30 minutes. We are at the close of our time. You're going to come back with us next week to finish up our discussions about space and also Mount Everest, correct?
Look forward to it. You
all
bet.
Right. Well, we are here with Dr. Scott E. Parazynski. Scott, we want to thank you for your time today, and we look forward to our discussion next week. This is Darrell Gunter, your host of Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM, Seton Hall University, and streaming on the web at WSOU.net. Remember, leadership begins with you.